11 o'clock. Welcome to WFVR-LP South Royalton. It's a Thursday, so it's time for Green Zine. Stay tuned for lots of interesting environmental information and education. A group of women that call themselves Mountain Man. This piece is called Bird Song. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio, and Green Zine is very happy to acknowledge our underwriters, and they include Soliflect. They are the tracking solar company based in Norwich. Also Bale, building a local economy. Find out more about them at balevt.org. Royal Trailworks, a company that Tom Wells runs here in the town of Royalton that designs snowmaking systems and trail building for the skiing and riding industry. Daniel Leibowitz, who's going to be joining us for our Pedal Power to the People event next Saturday the 10th. More information at our website on that, WFVR.org. The Upper Pass Beer Company, their four packs are available at most local establishments and several taps of their beer over at Carlita's Cantina. The First Branch Coffee Company, also a longtime supporter of the radio station, Solarfest over in Brandon, Vermont. And let me bring that down. I pulled the wrong thing down. White River Land Collaborative had a very successful event a couple of Sundays ago at their Burger Night. I think they've got another one planned in August. Hopefully I'm around and I can attend that. And finally, a restaurant that serves breakfast and lunch in Randolph, and I believe they're located on Merchants Row there. They're called Wit and Grit. Well, let's welcome somebody who's got a lot of grit and often some pretty interesting wit. Henry Swayze, how are you this morning?
Oh, thank you so much. And our master of ceremonies does it best.
Well, I don't know who that would be. But the technology is working at the moment. No wires have come loose, and we're not getting a lot of feedback or dead air. So let's carry on.
It's nice to know that someone might be hearing us.
Oh yeah, no, there are people out there listening. Don't worry about that. Great. Yeah. So that was called Bird Song. You probably haven't heard from Mountain Man before.
I have never heard from Mountain Man, and I love that. That's very special. And the bird note we're going to do today has a very interesting piece in it that it's not only about it's about fledgling birds.
Uh-huh.
And when they go out into the world on their own after they have had some time being supported by their parents, that they go to a slightly different community, maybe only a mile away, and try to set up a home for themselves, and they have to learn the local dialect.
Ooh.
of those same birds in that same area.
Hmm.
I thought that's a fascinating concept, and the intricacies of nature. And
yeah, I wonder if that has to do with like sort of lifespan resiliency. That if they just stayed with their parents and they didn't really kind of learn some more by being in a different group. But yeah, we will get to that in just a moment because we do play Bird Note every week. But let's talk about some of the other things that we're going to be talking about today. Why don't we start with who our guest is going to be in about 15 minutes or so?
Right. So our guest is Elena Bill Holly, who is the Vermont vice. I don't know what she
is. Conservation Law Foundation, CLF,
yeah.
I believe.
So
that's
she's
it.
She's the vice president of the Conservation Law Foundation. And so they have, she's both been involved with making Big Oil accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So that fits right in with the tail end of what I heard in Radio EcoShock. That you know, all the time there is no price to be paid for the pollution you're doing, for the impact on people that is negative, then the system just charges ahead to do whatever makes the most money. And capitalism becomes which it already largely is, the dominant driver of new activity. And that there was an interesting piece on that closing of, I only heard the very end as I was getting organized to do this show before that, but they said that AI helps to drive this. And we commented last week that John Kemp says that AI also drives positive things, that when you have complex, interrelated activities, and John Kemp was talking about the things you could do in soil and plant and human nutrition that all overlap, and how AI will actually allow us to make much better decisions about how to manage that system early on. It'll accelerate that learning curve dramatically. So AI has its good pieces and its bad pieces. It's a powerful tool, and you have to be careful what you direct it at, and that you fix the things that are counterproductive.
Yeah, and you know, Henry, I'm just going to stop right there. I just pulled out the big poster we have for this ongoing series, which actually wraps up today as far as first-time offerings, and it's the Hot Topics in Environmental Law, produced here on the campus of Vermont Law and Graduate School in South Royalton. And looking back a couple of weeks, because these lectures by experts in the area that they're talking about are available. They've all been taped and they're available. And I think we do have this website at a link at GreenZine at our website. To look at past shows, vermontlaw.edu/live. And the show that I'm referring to, it happened on Tuesday, July 23rd, How AI Can Help Transform the Electric Grid. So sort of a positive spin on that, much like you were just talking about. Heather Payne of the Moritz College of Law from Ohio State leads that talk. So I would highly recommend, if you want to delve in a little bit deeper than what you get here on GreenZine each week, that would be a really good resource.
Yes, indeed. On back to our grist mill for the show.
grist mill, yeah. Hand cranked, yeah. No AI necessary.
You know, I just like to put in a plug again for the links. I don't know how many people are making use of our show links, but it's at the bottom of the station website. If you just go to the station website and go to the very bottom of the page, there's a blue box that's links. And it's difficult for me to get the previous week's show in there so it can be listened to, because we can only listen to it on rebroadcast for a week. But we can listen to it. We can find it there long term as I build a bigger and bigger index of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the technology refuses to let me do it, and sometimes it does.
Ah, there you go.
But,
hit or miss.
But I try to do it every week. And And certainly last week's show was something that I think, I mean, it was, I was the the deliverer of lots of information during that show. But I think it bears sorting through, and the links to that show, the idea of nature having tipping points where, as you increase diversity, all of a sudden you get an explosion in
productivity,
nature thriving. Mm-hmm. And those things are worth digging into and thinking about and trying to find a way to relate to them. And we'll cover this at the end of the show this week, but there is a upcoming event with the on learning about soils and resiliency that we can get from treating soils right and making floodplains work and all those things to reduce the flooding that we're now seeing so much. White River Natural Resources Council has an event on that, which you can listen to or participate online, or you can be there in person.
Be there in person if you
Friday,
can.
Friday and Saturday. So that link is up there, and you can go and have a look at it if you want to attend that.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, as far as later in the program, after we have our discussion with Elena Mahaly from VLF, let's see, the Vermont, CLF, Conservation Law Foundation. We will also talk a little bit about batteries and EVs and where they may be in a year's time as far as compared to fossil fuel-driven vehicles. Also, some information coming in from the Vermont Council of Voters or Conservation Voters. They have a scorecard that's just been listed that we may link. I don't want to put too much work on you, Henry, on your off hours. And then some local information about cooling centers here in South Royalton. So we're really going to range around quite a bit today. But maybe we should go to check out these young birds here on Bird Note right now.
Indeed.
Okay, we'll do that, and we'll be right back with you after this. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. A songbird's first summer of life is hectic, especially for a newly fledged male. There is much to learn and very little time. Take the Buick's wren, for example, a sweet-singing wren residing throughout much of the western U.S. and locally in the east. A male Buick's wren chick emerges from the egg in early June. Within 2 weeks, he's already out of the nest, skulking in the shrubbery, awaiting feedings from his parents. Now, and over the next couple of weeks, the fledgling male learns at least 15 different song variations his father sings. At 5 weeks old, the young male wanders off on his own, searching for his own first territory in a bramble patch. He finds just the spot in August, about a mile from his birthplace. Now he must learn all the songs of the male Buick's wrens within earshot. For only by singing these local songs, which are all subtly different from his natal songs, will he be able to contend for a mate next spring. Whew! 30 or more songs to learn in the first 2 months of life, not to mention all the other challenges of survival in the wild. Bird songs we feature on Bird Note come from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I'm Frank Corrado.
And you can hear Bird Note just about every week during Green Zine at this time. Yeah, very interesting there, Henry. Oop, let me bring you up. Yeah.
To, I had to go back to 2021 to find that one.
Okay. Probably hasn't changed too much for those young wrens.
You know, pretty amazing. We Jane feeds birds right through the summer. We haven't had any bear invasions where we are in Burlington.
We have.
And,
yeah.
and there's an enormous explosion in the number of birds at the feeders in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I think it's all the fledglings that have come out of the nest and are making use of her bird feeders.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I'm almost certain it's very the feathers, I think, certainly the chickadees. I've seen a number of chickadees that look feathers don't look nicely laid down and you know, fully developed. And maybe it's just beat-up parents that have spent so much time feeding their young that they're worn out. But I think that's young birds, and they very rapidly become the size of or nearly the size of an adult. So pretty fascinating how fast birds and you think about humans. I mean, a human child in that first, you know, they go from a goo and a ga maybe when they're born, but by the time they're 1 year old, they're actually have got words, and by the time they're two or three, they are doing complex things with words, not just sentences, but making desires known and, you know, learning a whole syntax for the language.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect our language is a little more complicated even than the bird's language. So it's a fast learning curve for young animals, and their minds are very plastic at that point and can, whatever they're being directed at, big changes happen in a very short time. Go all the way to the beak of the purple finch, which is adaptation in one generation. We talked about seeds getting more powerful in last week's program when they're grown in good soil and then seed gathered and then replanted. They perform way better than the original seed did. And the beak of the purple finch were two kinds of finches, one that dealt with hard seeds and one that dealt with more vegetative material. And the island that they were being studied on went through extreme drought, and only the hard seed was available. And in one generation, the shape of the beak changed to adapt itself to that new food source.
Wow. So I'm going to shift gears, Henry. We're only a couple minutes away from our interview. I'm going to jump over to the Granite State, our neighbor to the east. Of course, that would be New Hampshire. Yesterday's Valley News, which actually is printed down in New Hampshire, had several environmental stories, and some of them touch on topics that we have covered or at least touched on here on Green Zine in the past. So I would highly recommend catching up with these stories. Over in New Hampshire, they are moving ahead with an interconnectivity bill because it's very cumbersome for renewable energy projects to get connected. And therefore, some of the developers who'd like to bring more renewable energy directly to New Hampshire are going elsewhere because there's just too much paperwork, and they get it all ready, and then it takes months and months for them actually to connect. There's an interesting story about that. And also one in the North Country where the timber industry is a major factor in the economy. And we're talking up near the Canadian border. There's a town called Pittsburgh, which is highlighted in this other article in the Valley News, and I'm sure you could probably find it online. There's a lot of pushback. There's a major out-of-state company that has bought up a significant stand of timberland to store carbon. And we have talked before about carbon credits, and I would say the bulk of this story, at least in that part of New Hampshire, is fairly negative on the carbon credits by saving that stand of forest and then maybe having a result on diminishing jobs and the welfare of local residents up there. So two New Hampshire-based stories. Henry has probably gone off to get our guest, so I'm going to turn him down, and we're going to go really hyper-local now while he lines up Elena Mahaly here on Green Zine. And yeah, it's another hot one today, possibly getting up to 90 degrees from where we broadcast here in South Royalton, Vermont. And towns are trying to adapt to climate change. We know what's happening with the heavy rains up north of here, and we may touch on that towards the end of the show. But right here in the town of Royalton, our select board has decided to add some additional town cooling stations. So when things get really hot, your air conditioner, the power goes off, you have somewhere to go to keep cool, because we know that serious health impacts as well as potential death is occurring in some places, many places actually around the world, particularly dense urban populations, because there are not cooling centers. So Emergency Management Director Brad Salzman was in front of the select board on July 23rd, and he asked that the town office building, which is located just across the river from our station, be added to the state list of cooling stations available in the town of Royalton. Right now, the Academy Building, the Library, the Senior Center, and Payne's Beach, well, I've been to most of those places, they are posted as cooling centers with a listing of hours and accessibility. Salzman pointed out that heat waves are starting earlier in the summer, lasting longer periods of time, and longer into the season. The town office building would not need to offer overnight accommodations or require staff involvement to be available. The board approved adding the town office building to the list of cooling stations and approved of an MOU to indemnify and hold harmless the use of private facilities for emergency or alternate shelters. So some good news for Royalton. If you're looking to cool off, well, soaking in the White River is a good spot over there at Payne's Beach, but you can go to the library, the senior center, and also to the town office building, which, of course, now is located over where the old Crawford's Automotive building was. Well, right now I'm going to take a chance and check back with Henry and see if he's been able to connect with our guest. Henry, are you there?
I am here, and I have Elena Mahaly online with me from the Vermont Conservation Law Foundation. So welcome to Green Zine, Elena.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Good morning, Elena. You know, I've seen your name crop up in the news, all in good ways, over the last couple of years, and it's great to have you on the air with us today.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure. I've been a listener for quite some time, and I was a law student at Vermont Law School, and cooled off plenty of times at that beach that you were just talking about.
Hey, you wouldn't happen to be related to Mark Mahaly, would you?
Yes, he likes to say that he's my dad. Yes, there is a relationship.
it's a unique name, and I met Mark when he was working here, and I believe he's working over in New Hampshire now, if I'm not mistaken.
So he actually is in the Vermont State Legislature.
Oh, wow.
Right now.
Excellent.
So, well, he's running again. But yeah, that's his recent chapter.
Okay, a future guest here on the air. But we're gonna talk to you today, Henry. Why don't you launch off with some good questions for Elena?
Yeah, I think we'll just turn you loose, Elena, on the legal notice that you presented to the Vermont Department of or Agency of Natural Resources for conforming with the law that they have to come up with good carbon accounting. I believe that's what it is, but I'm a generalist rather than a lawyer-like detailist, so... fill us in on what that is and what you see as problems and why you have put pressure on them to step up the table and do the work that they are supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. Well, you know, I'll start by just, you know, honoring what everyone woke up to this morning, which was like the reeling news of the nightmare that so many Vermonters lived through in Lindenville and other parts of the Northeast Kingdom in terms of surviving the flooding and just horrific torrential rains. I know I was brought to tears reading an article in Vermont Digger about this woman who was just swept out of her house in the middle of the night. It's so visceral what we're all facing in terms of the impacts of climate change being here and now and, you know, lapping at our doorsteps. So one of the goals of my organization, Conservation Law Foundation, is really to be holding the state accountable to doing everything that we can to not only prepare our state and make sure that, you know, we're taking measures to adapt to this new reality of climate change, but also doing our part to heed the warning that scientists are giving us, that is, we really only have the next few years as our best opportunity to slow the overheating of the planet. And, you know, I think that urgency is what motivated the Vermont General Assembly in 2020 to pass the law that you referenced, the Global Warming Solutions Act, sometimes it's referred to as the GWSA, that creates a framework for the state to slash and reduce over time our climate damaging emissions. And it set a near-term objective of 2025. And then has another more outer objective of 2030 and then 2050. And, you know, it represents Vermont and Vermonters doing our part to contribute to what is a global crisis, resolving this global crisis. And, you know, one of the roles the secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources has is to kind of steward the state's compliance with this law and with the requirement to ratchet down emissions over time. And here we are in August 2024. So our first requirement is coming up in January of 2025. And part of the law has the secretary conducting reviews every so often to kind of take stock of how we're doing as a state in meeting those objectives. And are we doing enough? Are the policies that we've adopted actually curbing emissions in the way that we thought they would? And one of the first reviews that the secretary was responsible for was due July 1st, so just a month ago. And it's really important to know that those reviews come up frequently throughout the course of the timeline of this law as report card opportunities. Mm-hmm. And this is the first one. So CLF, my organization, really has been paying attention to what that looks like. Imagine if you get a report card, you know, you kind of want to know what the factors are that the teacher or whoever is giving a grade used in sort of assessing progress to date. And going forward, you know, we want to make sure there's agreement on what those factors are. And what CLF took issue with is basically the modeling that the state is using to project whether we are on track to meet our 2025 emissions or not. The state relied on a model that it had kind of on hand and had been put together for a different purpose. And sort of imported that into this review or report card and said, hey, based on this model, we are generally on track to meet our 2025 emissions. But we, you know, closely reviewed the model, the data inputs, and the consultants who put together the model produced a report. And in that report, there's a disclaimer that says, this model should not be used for the purpose of predicting whether or not we are on track to meet 2025 emissions. It plainly says it shouldn't be used for that purpose, and yet the agency plugged that right into their report card review determination and said, hey, based on this model, we're on track. which this isn't actually just about like what model they use, but there's actually big implications for the fact that they use that. And the implication is that it paints a much rosier picture. It shows that we're making it, when in fact, if you calibrate the model properly to real historic emissions, as CLF did, you know, it actually shows that the state is on track for material failure. We are not on track to meet our emission targets in 2025. And, you know, what we're fighting for is just pressuring the agency to be real with Vermonters about our progress to date. You know, I think no matter what side of the aisle that you're on, whether you think that we should be doing more as a state or less, I think people will agree that they at least want the facts. They want to know where we're at.
So was that model largely based on electricity and that side of it, or does it actually take a much broader attempt at tracking carbon emissions?
It does take a broader multi-sectoral analysis approach. So it is a comprehensive model. It's called the LEAP model. But traditionally, that model and the way that the state has historically used it is to kind of try out different policies and say, hey, if we adopted something like a clean heat standard, which is a market-based incentive program to try and reduce thermal sector carbon emissions, if they plug that into the model, they can get a sense of what would the emission reduction change be if we implemented that program. So they could get a delta. There's a baseline. They can plug in a potential program, and they can get spit out from that model, this is how much emission reductions you would see sector-wide. The problem is the baseline of the LEAP model is artificially high just because of the way that model works, and it's not calibrated with actual historic emissions data, and it's not aligned entirely with the method that the state uses for its own greenhouse gas inventory. And that's okay for some purposes. If all you care about is assessing the delta, the change in emissions that you'd see by implementing a program, if you say, you know, our baseline is 100 and we do this program and it reduces emissions by 20, great, that's significant. But if your goal is to say, we have this outer term emission reduction requirement in 2025, how are we doing? How many emission reductions have we have? Using a model like that doesn't work, and it's sort of a thumb on the scale problem because it has an artificially high baseline. So right from the get-go, it makes it look like you're 50% of the way there when in fact, you know, you have to start closer to zero. So it's a complicated subject in some ways, but to distill it down, it's really about making sure that the state is using as close to real historic emissions data as possible to tell as truthful of a projection as possible of where we are at and whether what we're doing is enough. And if I were a lawmaker, I would go into the next session with a very different mindset if I know that the state missed its first Global Warming Solutions Act target or was on track to, versus we're good, we made it, we don't need to worry as much. And so I think that's why we sent this notice letter and why we're putting pressure on the agency to correct their model and correct the public determination they made that we're on track to meet this target, because we think that's an overly optimistic and misleading statement to leave Vermonters with when really we need to be doubling down. We're likely to miss that target, and you know, really need to be doing everything we can to keep cutting emissions.
Yeah, I just real quick thinking about your comment about it's kind of like a thumb on the scale, and I'm not going to ascribe intent anywhere along this process, and I do have a question at the end of it, but just for listeners that may be new to this show or new to Vermont, that the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed over a governor's veto. It was very controversial at the time as far as the executive's role, and that would, of course, include executive agencies like the ANR, and the head of ANR is an appointed position. So there are at least the specter of politics playing a role. But then to get to my question, and that is, what do folks at CLF and other nonprofits that have been pushing hard with legislators over the last several years? This isn't something that just came up in the last 2 years. We know that the timeline for making change and reforms and having less greenhouse gases in the environment globally, much less here in Vermont, is really shrinking fast. What parameters, not just the modeling, but data that's out there, do you and CLF and other groups think that the administration and the ANR are either ignoring or missing that to catch up on this and give an accurate scorecard? What do they need to dig into a lot further and come up with objective information?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there's two kind of facets to your question. One is, I just want to agree with you that it's hard not to see politics sort of showing up here. And I know that there has been a great deal of frustration from leaders in the legislature around their efforts to try and tackle climate change being thwarted by the executive branch in more than one ways. And I think you saw that in the number of climate bills. You're seeing that, how many got vetoed and how many, even if they aren't vetoed, we anticipate the agency responsible for implementing them is going to come back and ask for a delayed timeline or, just doesn't actually rulemake when they should. So a core part of our role at CLF is to play watchdog and to make, hold accountable the administration to actually enforce and heed to the laws that were passed by the General Assembly. And the Global Warming Solutions Act, as you said, it was controversial when it passed, but it is still the law of the land. There are many people that are expecting the state to act in their best interest in implementing it. As far as the data that you're asking about, I'm happy to say it's not anything elusive or hard to come by. Mm-hmm. What's kind of surprising about all of this is that it's the state's own historical emissions data that it tracks through its own greenhouse gas inventory. That's the data that we're asking them to plug into this model. They have better access to it than anyone. We're also asking them to make sure that this model is calibrated in a way that aligns with the methodologies in the state's own greenhouse gas emissions inventory, which it just released its latest inventory a couple of weeks ago. That's something it does every year. It's very familiar with the methodology. And so we're not developing some new way of doing things that we're asking the state to align with. We're asking them to use their existing methods and their own data to better closely, for sort of a more lay person, I know the word calibration can be kind of technical sounding, but it's really just everyone knows that a model is doing the best. It's only as good as whatever inputs you put into it. And you want to make sure that those inputs are as close to reality as you can get. And this is really just an example of where a model was not sort of iterated and improved on in a way where the inputs were as accurate as they can be. Our ideal outcome here is not that we have to ultimately sue. We sent this notice letter as a serious request that the agency sit down and meet with us and hear out our concerns that the review they did is relying on a model that is not meeting the requirements of the statute and should be better calibrated. And we think that's well within the state's ability to do with limit, you know, with the time we have before January 2025 to at least update that model and more accurately track our progress. Now, that's a different question of, you know, do we think that the agency is actually going to meet those targets? And are we forcing them to do something right now in order to ensure that we do? That's not what we're doing here. Like, I think we're on track, as I said, for not meeting those targets. And I think that it's sad that the agency has been using this inappropriate model all year long to tell lawmakers and the Climate Council and the general public that we're good. We don't need to do anything more. We're going to meet 2025 with business as usual. We don't have to focus on that. Because I think it's been lost time that we could have had the introduction of a new rule or a new policy or public debate, discourse and debate in the legislature about what should we do to further curb emissions so that we can meet these targets. I just think that's disappointing and that's a loss, but we can't make up for that time in the next 4 months before January. It takes too long to even move a rule through the process. So I think, you know, I just want to be clear at this point, what we're asking for is really just honest math, transparent and more accurate accounting of our progress to date so that, you know, we are confronted with the sobering reality that, like, we're going to miss our target and that we need to be doing even more.
Yeah, yeah. Henry?
Well, I'd like to just say thank you for shining a light on this. I've had a more deep dive into the electric side of things, and certainly there was a lot of greenwashing going on in just how green the state's electric grid was. And I won't bother getting into details, but it seems to be the desire of the executive branch to not do anything that might generate an economic hardship on anyone today without much of regard for what it might do to us in the following years. It seems to be very, very focused on the here and now of the economics and willing to accept very dicey math.
Yeah. And
yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I
was just going to say that what I keep hearing is the term affordability. And yeah. I really have been pushing back and saying affordable for who?
Yeah.
Because if you think about the future generations, what we're doing right now is not affordable. And no version of, you know, inaction is affordable. So we absolutely need to bear in mind the cost realities of many Vermonters who are living with low income. And we're working hard to make sure these policies have, you know, equitable principles written into them. But the cost of inaction is something that needs to be factored in for both the near term and far.
Yeah. So I just have two quick things. One, to remind, I believe that coming up in January when the legislature convenes again in Montpelier, that will be the beginning of a new biennium. I think we just finished one and we're starting another one. And I've heard from legislators before that a lot of the groundwork to prepare bills, changes, reforms, et cetera, are done kind of what we would say is the off season. Committees continue to get together, and by about the middle of December, a lot of what is going to be discussed and maybe move forward in the first year of the biennium is already sort of baked in. So if information coming from, this sounds very flawed model that the ANR is working on and isn't at least turned around in the right direction, a lot of that debate that's coming up is not really going to be based on actual, you know, trends that are happening. So that's one comment. And then a question is, Elena, do you have any sort of quantitative idea if an appropriate model had been used and implemented and some of this information was actually going to be ready by the end of December, which sounds unlikely, what the difference in percentage could be between the flawed model and a much more accurate? I don't think we're talking like 1 or 2% and you know, sort of skirmishing. This sounds like a significant difference in outcome.
Yeah, I mean, well, I appreciate your first comment. That's absolutely right. We're starting a new biennium, and a lot of the discussion about what bills lawmakers want to focus on, that begins as early as, you know, September, October sometimes. And one clarification that I just want to be respectful to the consultants who, you know, developed this sleep model, that there's nothing wrong with the model itself. What we're taking issue with are the inputs that were put into this version of the model. So I just feel like there's nothing wrong with using a LEAP model for purpose of prediction, but you should make sure that your inputs are accurate and as closely hewed to real numbers based on historical data as possible. So that's one just like sort of subtle nuance. In terms of what the secretary wrote in her July 1 review letter, that the state was generally on track to meet the 2025 emission reduction target, but we found, based on our retaining an emissions accounting expert, that correctly fine-tuning the model would have predicted the state actually being off track of that emission target by about 365,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So what this means is that the secretary is predicted to cut less than half of as much as emissions as she's required to by January 2025. So instead of being like, yay, we made it, we're 100% there, like what this is saying is that like actually we're about 50% of the way there.
Yeah, big difference. Yep.
And so the next big hurdle down the road is 2030, where we have a new emissions reduction goal we have to meet. And that one, I think even the administration was saying, was a little dicier to get to than this nice, easy one that we probably didn't make in 2025.
That's right. And I think that's why we took the action now that we did, is to say, hey, you know, we cannot be resting on our laurels at all, not for this near-term one and certainly not for 2030. We need to be in action, in gear, throwing all the ideas on the wall to really attain these science-based standards that were democratically, you know, enacted, and that allow us to do our part to cut global emissions. I don't have a lot of sympathy for people that claim that Vermont is so small that we don't make a difference. Because if everyone took that mentality, then we would be, you know, a world on fire. And so I think that we have a moral imperative to stay true to our commitments you know, a physical need globally for everyone to be taking these steps to have a livable planet for our future.
So going in a kind of boomerang kind of way, I'm wondering whether you've been champions of the holding big oil accountable for the damage that they've done to state infrastructure in trying to generate a Superfund site that they would have to contribute to help offset that. And that's, I think, an enormously valuable thing, because as we heard in Radio EcoShock, that the event of AI is just, if there aren't any costs involved in the
in the damage being done by for-profit operations, that we'll see that accelerated ever so much faster. The capitalist system will range. And I'm wondering whether, I mean, I realize that big oil is probably going to take this into the courts and try and keep it there forever. But if that money were to come in, would that be significantly helpful in terms of reducing our future carbon emissions?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked. To back up for listeners that might not know about this exciting first-in-the-nation law that Vermont passed this last session, it's called the Climate Superfund Act. And what it does, CLF was a huge champion of this as basically a continuation of a very old principle in environmental law, which is the polluter pays principle. If you have an example of a contaminated site and damages as a result, who are you going to make pay for the cleanup, the polluting entity or the general public? And that principle stands for, like, you make the polluter pay. They were in the best seat to understand the risks of their commercial engagement and behavior, and they reaped profit from it, and they are, you know, if you're going to choose, they're the ones that should pay, or at least contribute and chip in their fair share to the problem. And what this does is it takes that principle and applies it to the atmosphere and climate change. And it says that, you know, the largest fossil fuel companies who contributed to global warming, that they should be paying their fair share for the ensuing adaptation and flood relief and recovery costs that we have to pay for here in Vermont as a result of the impact of their products on the atmosphere. And so at its, you know, simplest, this law now requires the state treasurer to do a big cost accounting of how much emissions from the biggest oil companies over a certain period of time, it's 1995 to 2024, what damages have those emissions wrought on Vermont? And once that number is calculated, the Agency of Natural Resources basically divides it up among the top fossil fuel, emissions, fossil fuel companies that have emitted to the atmosphere, and then issues a bill to those companies that are deemed responsible parties under the law based on their size and based on their contribution to the problem during that time window. So it is a law that hopefully once it survives the legal challenges that we anticipate from the oil and gas industry, as you alluded to, will allow Vermont to be in a position of seeking recovery, for cost recovery for these damages. And yes, you know, absolutely, the law and is anticipating those to go towards things like adapting to climate change, towards implementing solutions that better prepare us to withstand the impacts of climate change we know are coming.
Well, will that cost factor be based on just state programs or state costs like roads and things, or will it actually include people like the houses that have been flooded twice in Barry and things like that?
Yeah, the way that the statute is written is it is broader than just the state's costs, but Vermonters' costs to businesses, costs to individual homeowners. But it's, you know, the treasurer is just starting to engage in that exercise of doing the cost assessment, and the treasurer does have discretion about, you know, which damages in the state have basically like cost assignments that feel defensible and real to assign. because I think everybody knows there's more cost out there than we can possibly, with certainty, assign a dollar amount to. So
right.
I think that's got to stand up in court. Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, well, we need to stand up right now. We've only got about five and a half minutes left in the show. So from the studio here of Green Zine and Royalton Community Radio, I really want to thank you, Elena, for joining us here on the air. Henry?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. You're doing great work. Keep it up.
Thanks for your spotlighting CLF work.
All right. We'll be in touch again soon, Elena.
Okay, thank you.
And I have put up on the on our links the voting record of the last legislative session, and you can see how many of them required a government a override of the governor's veto, and what all the good stuff that happened was.
Yeah, and along that, as far as kind of reporting on that, and also a current report card on our legislators, if you go to the VNRC, that's the Vermont Natural Resource Council, you will see a scorecard there of our legislators, and there's a whole lot of other good thing. In fact, I'm going to bring up the subject of beer, Henry. One of the stories there... Zero Gravity, Green State for Good. Now, they're not an underwriter of the radio station, so we're not trying to plug them at all. But they have received from the Vermont Conservation Voters their Green State for Good fundraiser. And they give a dollar out of each beer that they sell to loyal nonprofits, environmental nonprofits like the VCV. There's an art walk mentioned also at the VNRC. There is a whole lot going on, Henry, but we do have time, barely, to get to maybe just a little bit of EV talk. I can add one more thing. If you are starting to look around for EVs, one critical thing, depending on how you drive, is the ability of that specific EV, how fast it can take a charge. They kind of range around. There was a scorecard that came out last week that named a number of vehicles that can take electricity at a much higher rate, more like maybe topping off in 18 minutes, while other vehicles might take as much as 45 minutes to an hour. So that's another little sort of data point that you might want to add in your future search for getting off of fossil fuel transportation. And Henry, I think you've got something about batteries.
I do. The cost of batteries over a three-year period has dropped quite dramatically and is scheduled to continue to do so. And that is having a lot to do with the cost of electric vehicles. There is a link to a Goldman Sachs article that says that by next year, 2025, the cost of an electric vehicle for a similar gas vehicle should be price comparative. So that's a pretty nice step up, because that's what will start to open the floodgates of people going to electric, is when they aren't paying a premium price for them.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the Climate Forward article that came out from the New York Times just a couple days ago. We might dig a little bit deeper into one of these stories because the Democratic, the expected Democratic nominee for president, Kamala Harris, is going to be choosing her. She might have even done it this morning, for all I know, her running mate. And there is a story that examines the potential running mate's stand on climate. I know, for instance, that the governor of Pennsylvania is being considered, and he, at least on one environmental issue, has stood firm about supporting fracking in the state of Pennsylvania. So that might be something that we talk about next week when we know who that nominee is for the Democratic Party. Henry, real quick, and then I'm going to throw it back to you. What?
I see politics creeping in here.
Yeah. Well, no, it's just we want to know where these people stand, at least based on their past
past
history.
Legislative scorecards help you with that.
Yeah, they definitely do. Real quick, our underwriters, and then I'll leave it to you, Henry, are Brocklebank Craft Brewing. Also, we get support from Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Henry, we've got just under a minute to go. Go ahead.
Yes, there's another upcoming event that is posted already on our links page. And Dr. Martin Frick, who is director of the World Food Program Global Office in Berlin, is actually going to be doing a presentation on world food supply and where it's going and how we fix farming to make it work better. And that's this Saturday at 5 o'clock at Thetford Community Center. And you can get the details on that. It's free and open to the public. And there is a potluck. If it's not raining, there will be a potluck following as well.
Sounds good.